Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Screen Geeks Radio. This is Dave.
This is Barry.
And Josh.
You know, normally we would do talk about banter and what movies we've seen and news, DVD releases. Yeah, screw it all. This week we are joined. We are pleased to have the director and the mind and heart and soul behind the upcoming Pit in the Pendulum stop motion film coming out on DVD here pretty soon. We have Mark Luigi. Thanks for joining us,
hey!
Sir.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Yes. Hey, you know, I still can't stop talking about it since Starfest, so.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes, yes. You're still plugging away working on the DVD, huh?
I am indeed, yeah. Working on the extra features, getting all the stuff together, the menus and everything, and, you know, like we were saying, just trying to make this as cool a video experience as anybody would want it to be, or like you'd expect it to be, coming from, you know, the place it's coming from with Ray and Edgar Allan Poe and stop motion and, you know, all that craziness. So we're just working hard on it, trying to get it out for June, late June, hopefully.
Cool. Yes, we'll be posting, waiting with eager anticipation and such. You know, where do you want to start, Barry? There's so many questions to ask. Oh, my goodness.
So many. I want to throw this out really quick because I was reading about this the other day, how they've been trying to make a movie about the life of Edgar Allan Poe for years and years and years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm sure you heard about at one point Michael Jackson.
Yeah, Stallone's got a script, actually.
Yes. Well, I want to ask you, like, what do you think of that, and who would your choice be for an ideal actor as Edgar Allan Poe?
Well, it's two guys, actually, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. We're actually working on a stop-motion version of an Edgar Allan Poe, not a biography, but an adventure story based on a short period in Edgar Poe's life.
Wow.
Yeah,
cool.
It's kind of a project we've been working on a little bit at a time as we go with the DVD and, you know, as the priority. This is kind of like the secondary thing that we're going to try and launch after with the rave and all this other stuff. But not to go on too much of a tangent, with that in mind, I through Fred Fuchs, one of our executive producers, with Ray, he had mentioned that Stallone had a script that he'd written about Edgar Allan Poe, which was a biography, you know, novelization film. And he ended up getting Viggo Mortensen to sign on as Poe. And that was probably my number one choice.
Wow.
And that would be me picking. And I said, wow, he totally nailed it with Viggo. The guy he had before that was Morton Downey Jr. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. Morton Downey Jr. That would have been really interesting. Robert Downey Jr., but then he got on Iron Man. So Robert Downey Jr. was apparently attached, and then he got on Iron Man and dropped out. But he would be, like, the most amazing Poe, I think. That guy would be incredible.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay.
So he'd be funny. He'd be really, you know, poignant. He'd be intense, sarcastic. I mean, he's got all those characteristics that Poe had.
And Stallone wrote this screenplay?
Yeah, apparently he did. Now, this isn't, like, you know, written in stone coming from me, but from what I've been led to believe for, like, 2 years now, Stallone had this screenplay he wrote, and he's been shopping it around for a long time, and he hasn't been able to get anybody to do it. So the plan was he was going to launch into that after Rambo.
Wow.
So and right after that, he snagged Viggo Mortensen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. But there's no training montages or explosions in the screenplay?
Yeah, there's no heads exploding. I don't know how they're going to make the film.
Yeah. Well, why don't you give us a little bit of background, how you got started in stop motion and what you've done? I mean, you've got a pretty lengthy career going here, so I just wanted to give people an idea of what all you've done.
Well, it's been a while. It's kind of I'll try and keep it brief so I don't, you know, put anybody to sleep. But I started up, I was really young. I was 14, I think, 13 or 14, when I really got a grip on what stop motion was. I mean, I'd seen Star Wars, and I'd been growing up with creature double features, and of course, pretty much anything Ray had ever done on TV that I could get my hands on. I lived in the backwoods in New Hampshire, so there wasn't a whole lot of choices, and there was certainly no film theaters or anything nearby. So it's just what I could get on the TV. And I met a guy when I was working in a playhouse, like building scenery for a summer stock theater, and he turned me on to King Kong and not so much the film, but how it was done. And he had all these books on Ray Harryhausen. He just happened to be a giant fan of Ray Harryhausen. I said, oh my God, where did all this stuff come from? Where did you find these books and these films and this information? And so we ended up spending a couple summers just like poring over all this stuff that he had, all these special effects books and everything. And he was very much into the art and the technique of stop motion. So that's really what got me turned onto it in a big way. And then that's when I realized that the idea of, you know, maybe one day doing something like that would be great. And he kind of helped me to realize that this is what I wanted to do with my life, was to make these sorts of films. At that point, I had no idea how you went about it. Right? There was nobody I knew that even owned a film camera, you know, or anything. So I ended up taking off and went to a film, took a film program at Wellesley Senior High School in Massachusetts. So I left home when I was 15 and went down to live outside of Boston and managed to get myself through high school and took film programs and photography programs and just shot Super 8 film every summer, you know, while I was working and whatnot, just developing a style and kind of learning how to make these films so I could get into college and continue to do so, and eventually got through college and started directing in Boston at a little animation shop called Olive Jar. And from there, my first directing job was the ABC Saturday Morning IDs, the Cowboy and the Horse. He goes, after these messages, I'll be right back.
Nice.
Cool.
I got paid $6 an hour to do those. And I was knocking them out like 4 hours for each one. So I think I was probably the lowest paid director in the country at the time. Because I was animating them and directing them, and, you know, it was so simple. It was kind of a trial for me at the time, but I knocked them out, and they loved it, and the lip sync worked, and they're like, all right, that's it. It's great, you know, and there's your $24 for that one. And this one was only 3 hours, so we'll give you 18 for that one. And
you're just too efficient.
Well, it's interesting. That was my first pro gig, you know, and I'd interned there for a little while before that, making films and whatnot while I was in college. So this is happening while I'm in college. And shortly after I bailed out of school, I didn't quite finish. I got 3 years in, and I was working full-time at the studio and as an animator and director. So that was it. Then I ended up going to New York, and I worked on Bud Bowl, the second Bud Bowl, the one with the giant football stadium and Bud Light versus Bud Bowl, and I was one of the three key animators on that.
Cool.
And yeah, that was really my big push into New York, that job. And geez, I don't even remember when that was. I think that was 1989 that I did that. And that was the biggest ad campaign, the biggest ad campaign in the world that year. It was something like 368 million people saw that 1 minute spot during the halftime. I mean, it was insane.
A resume builder there.
Right? It was huge. It was just such a big deal. I had no idea. And I was out having a drink with the producer, Russ Dubé, who's still my close friend. I'm actually going down to see him in New York this week. We were just sitting there having a beer talking about it. And he says, you know, this is going to be the biggest ad campaign on the planet. I was like, yeah, they all are, aren't they? And he says, no, I'm serious, you know. And then he started throwing me the numbers, and I was just flabbergasted about what we're doing, like these little cans and bottles on a stage in New York. This little set is going to be, you know, broadcast around the globe live, you know. So it's just, wow, it was crazy. But that was the big kick. That was the big kick for me into the industry. And I felt like, well, this is it. I guess this is how it starts. You know, you read about these moments when people get into the business, and this is like this turning point for them at some place, some fulcrum that they hit, and they realize, wow, I guess I'm really in the industry now. And that was it for me. That was the time that I said, well, I guess I'm fully integrated into this, you know, and now the adventure really gets going. And it kind of hasn't stopped since. Yeah, so here we are, you know.
Very cool. Yeah, and you've worked on Celebrity Deathmatch, is that correct, too?
I did, yep. Oh, I put in, I was on that for 52 episodes. 52, 22 and a half minute episodes of animated mayhem. It was a crazy job. It was just so crazy. I happened to be living in Connecticut at the time. I took a couple of years off. Well, not really off. I was living in Connecticut and just sort of backed out of the industry for a little while because I got so burned out. I was just working so much. And, you know, an animation's a tough gig. It's really, it takes so much out of you to stay focused for 18 hours a day and 7 days a week on these huge campaigns. And it just kind of sucks the life out of you. And so I took some time off, and during that time, the folks at MTV, I had some friends working there on the show, Deathmatch, and they said, you know, come down and work on this with us, and come down. And I kept saying no. I said, no, I don't think I want to do that right now. I just really don't want to do it. And it wasn't like I was being a diva. I was just exhausted, you know. I was, like, mentally, I was working with, you know, half a brain, and you know, the synapses weren't firing. And I was just like, I just can't put myself through it right now. I gotta kind of restore myself. So after they did that for about a year, they're chasing me down, and I finally said, okay, I think I'll come down and talk to you guys, and saw what they were doing, and you know, said, I'll tell you what, if I can make some changes in how you guys approach this, like fix the pipeline up, change the puppet construction, you know, if we can change things, then I think I'd really be into being here. So I jumped in, and it was just like a crazy train ride for like 2.5 years. It's just insane.
Wow.
You know, we're pumping these shows out so fast.
Now,
burning up puppets, like 30 something puppets an episode. You know what I mean? Like, it was just nuts. We had sometimes, you know, 15 stages going at the same time.
Jeez.
So,
wow.
Yeah, and I'm like lighting stuff and directing rooms and running around and fixing stuff and running down to the VFX and dealing with those guys and running over to the post guys and doing edit. And, you know, it literally we ended up incorporating, like, you know, those scooters, those little tiny metal fold-up scooters?
Yeah.
At one point, we had those things on the floor for the folks working on the crew, like the directors and the ADs, to get from one end of the building to the other. Like, we're at the 35th floor in Times Square in this building, right? So you wouldn't think it's a huge amount of space, but the amount of times you run back and forth between all these different rooms inside the square of the floor of the building, you probably did 5 or 6 miles that day.
Wow.
So you just, you know, and it's high speed. You haven't got time to kind of saunter around talking to people. So you got walkie-talkies, and we're on walkie-talkies, and we had to create protocol for people to talk on the walkie-talkies because there were so many people that were on this crew that needed to get information back and forth. Storyboard guys, set guys, puppets, models, props, meetings, directors. It was crazy. So we got these scooters, and we're, like, skipping around on those things. And it was a completely insane experience. Yep. That was Deathmatch.
Now, Mark, for your film, Edgar Allan Poe's The Pit and the Pendulum, such a visually rich film, did you storyboard a good deal of it?
I did. Yep. And I didn't do storyboards in the traditional sense that we had, you know, dedicated sheets with panels on them. What I ended up doing, just to kind of trim things down a bit time-wise, because we were really crunched for time, was I took the script that Matt Taylor had worked out with me, and I thumbnailed it. Well, basically, which is doing, like, instead of a, you know, standard format storyboard panel, which is, I guess, like 2 by 3 image, 2 inches by 3 inch panel or drawing, I was doing these thumbnails, which are like doing little postage size stamped sketches. And I would incorporate those into the script pages. So as I'm reading through the script, I just start doing these sequences of thumbnails as though they were like my mini storyboards. Because it's much faster for me to just do like a pen and ink little sketches.
Yeah.
For this show in particular, because it was like, it was, you know, light and dark and black and white. So it was really graphical, and it would help me to visualize readily what I was shooting for images to go with the script. So that's really what we ended up going off of for storyboards. So I would take what I ended up doing is taking the pages of the script I had with all the thumbnails in them, scanning them and running them into Photoshop, cutting out all the thumbnails and then enlarging them, and then using those as the storyboards for the animation guys and myself.
Very cool. I have a quick random question. Well, it's not a random question. This is something that, you know, this is like my chance to get to talk to you and ask questions I've always wondered.
Yeah,
go ahead. What goes into making these puppets? Besides a crap load of work.
Besides the mind-bending horror of, like, spending your afterlife building them. No, it's this there's so much that goes into them that's really, it's a pile of small things. It's like a pile of details, as opposed to, you know, sculpting the character and you're just done. That's just a part of it. That's just one aspect of it. So you start with the drawings, go into the sculptures, molding, casting, and whatever material you're going to use, building the armature itself, the skeletal construction that's going to hold everything in place. So it'll stand on its own feet on the set, and the puppet itself. The mechanisms for the facial movements, the eyes, the hair moving around. then there's the costume design and the costume construction, and then the putting the costume onto the puppet, and then working out the idiosyncrasies with the puppet, like tweaking it and making any repairs that you need to or fixes so it'll operate smoothly and not sort of break itself up as you're working with it. Each one of these things is really a prototypical sort of mechanism. You know, whenever you build one of these puppets, it's prototypical in a sense that oftentimes you're not replicating these things by the dozen. So you're only building a few of them.
Wow.
And you don't oftentimes build enough of them to sort of work out I should back up a little bit. On smaller productions like mine, you wouldn't be making four or five of these things. So we wouldn't set up jigs in a machining room to cut the same piece five times in a row, then grab the next piece, cut each one of those the same way. And then, like something like Corpse Bride or Nightmare Before Christmas, they have, you know, a dedicated machining room that, and the guys running that stuff and doing the milling and the assembly, those guys are experts at building super nice armatures. So we don't have any of that. I can't afford these guys. I don't have that kind of dough. So I ended up doing it myself, and it's not a problem. I've been building my own armatures forever, right? So I just go into it, but each one's kind of specific to the purpose it's supposed to have, and that means it's got its own idiosyncrasies and its own weight to strength, joint strength issues, and how much weight can you have at the end of an appendage and equal, you know, versus how big of a joint at the shoulder does that have to be, and does that fit inside the sculpture, and is that going to work with the range of action and motion that you're planning, and, you know, it just goes on and on. So it's physics and geometry and all this stuff has to be worked out before you start. So I don't know if I'm getting bouncing around too much around the bush, but it's just so much that has to go into that that you have to think about in a linear fashion, from drawing the image, like this is what the character looks like, to actually having a puppet that's finished and bolted to your set and ready to be animated.
Wow. Now, you were talking about doing facial expressions. Now, do you have different heads to do that, or do you actually like animate the face itself?
Well, with this project in particular, I animated the face itself because I wanted to I wanted to use silicone skin, silicone rubber for the skin, so because of the light properties it has, so it looks like flesh, you know, and I could tint it with from inside intrinsically, so it would look like skin. And I just really like the idea of how it looked on a really big screen with HD. You know, you can see all the pores, and it just looks beautiful. So we ended up using, which basically worked out to be like skin, like a rubber mask that slid over an armature, like a plastic skull for each one of the puppets that we had. And that's kind of a takeoff of when I was doing animatronic puppets. Years ago, I used to do a lot of special effects makeup stuff, and I built these really big radio control and cable control puppets for films and music videos and stuff. And I used the same technology, only miniaturized it for the puppets to get that look. That's one way to do it, and that's how we did it with the Poe film. Just because on the pit, it also helped us with time. We didn't have a whole lot of time to make replacements, which would be heads that you'd replace for each frame at a set expression or a set mouth. You know, that means to do that, it's faster on the set to actually replace the heads and animate, but you had to invest the time before you started shooting in creating all those mouths, all the heads, testing them, you know, several times minimally to make sure that they all work the way you want them to. So in the end, you don't really save any time. It actually takes more time to build those heads to speed up your onset time. But I didn't have any time either way. You know, it was me working alone to build the puppets before we started shooting. And then when we started shooting, we only had 6 weeks to get the entire film, you know, out the door and off the set. So I couldn't have it both ways. I couldn't do replacement heads to speed up the shoot because I was also working on all the other aspects of getting the film ready with Susan, Susan Ma, the producer. So it was just us plowing away like crazy and Matt writing the script and trying to get all the stuff together before we got on the shoot. So we didn't have time to actually build replacements, so we ended up going with the rubber skin technique, and that worked pretty well for us. I mean, we get a lot of expression out of the characters.
Oh, absolutely. You give a lot of heart.
Yeah, and it was without any lip sync. It's because we got away without the lip sync because the mechanisms in the heads was just for jaw movement. And the silicone is so flexible that you could get a tremendous amount of shape changes out of his mouth just by flexing the jaw, like moving it to the left or to the right or pulling it down or pushing it up so the lips would compress. And, you know, they had like a mask to them, a fleshy mask to them. So it actually looked like there was musculature going on underneath the skin. And that was because of the silicone rubber.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Mark, we're going to be bouncing all over the place with this interview. There's so much to ask.
Mark, I wanted to ask you because there's a lot of filmmakers who obviously share your love for stop motion, which is, you know, such a classic visual effects style. You mentioned the Wellesley Film School. Where would you recommend filmmakers go to learn about stop motion?
Well, I was in a program, a film program. It wasn't really like a college, but it was a Wellesley Senior High. It was a really great high school for me to go to. And they had a great teacher there, Jack Rutledge, who I hope he hears this sometimes. He was such a huge force in propelling me into this thing. And so that was what I got lucky in high school, having that kind of access to cameras and a film program, photography. But I think nowadays there's not very much stop motion specific training going on that's in organizations, really. It's most of it's videos that you can pick up online, or there's a tremendous amount of books now that have the technique nailed down. Like Kit Laborn's got a great book on animation. The guys from Aardman have Nick Park and those guys at Chicken Run and Wallace and Gromit. They've done a couple of great books, wonderful books on the basics of stop motion animation and puppet construction and storyboarding and telling a story. So I would say that that's probably the best place to start is go to the bookstore and grabbing some of these books through Amazon or whatever and reading and then experimenting yourself. And the experimental part is a lot easier than it was when I was learning because it's not film based. It's not Super 8 film and 16. It's, you know, grabbing your little digital camera and setting it up on your table and shooting your characters, whatever they're made of, clay or rubber, you know, little stick figures, G.I. Joes, Barbies, Micronauts. I made stacks of films with Micronauts, you know, when I was in high school. It's crazy. But they're totally usable. They're completely usable. And then I got into clay, like using clay to do all kinds of stuff. And anything you can shape or form or move readily on a small set like your tabletop is perfectly fine for learning how to animate. And, you know, if you have a computer or a laptop or anything simple like that, or even just a camera, just a digital video camera that can, like a handy camera or whatever, that can shoot single frames, you can animate with that. So it's all about the experience, I think. It's less so about going to a school. I mean, there's film workshops and whatnot around in various towns and whatnot. If you go online, you can find these places and, you know, take courses with those guys or go to a college and maybe they're teaching animation once a week or whatever. But really, I think the best way to go about it is grab some books, look at some of this stuff online, find some tutorials on what people are doing for process and technique and just their frame by frame mode that they go in. Like, this is what I do when I start, this is what I do here, this is what I do here. There's tons of that stuff online. And then just shoot it yourself. That's really the best way to learn is to shoot yourself.
Pretty much learning by doing.
Just do it. Yep. Just grab a camera and start shooting stuff. And there's plenty of free software for the digital end of it online. You know, there's Frame. Well, there's a lot of guys have demo versions like Frame Thief and and iStop Motion, and you know, like, there's so many of these programs, and lots of them have built-in demos that you can use for a week or 2 weeks or a month or whatever, and see if you like the software. And if you like it, it's cheap. You know, the stuff's so inexpensive, and it helps you with the process tremendously. So really, it's about doing it on your own. Just doing it on your own, and that's the best way to learn, because you'll see what works for you in getting the stuff accomplished.
Very cool. I just to move on a little bit to the theme of Pit and the Pendulum, one thing that was very striking to me is a lot of stop motion is done, you know, like Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach, whatever, you know, Corpse Bride. This was framed instead of, you know, doing a dancing storyline. This is almost seems like it was set up as a silent film. Was that a conscious choice?
It was set up as a what?
It almost seems like the narrative was set up more as a silent film. I mean, you have the narrator over top, you know, narrating everything, but was that a conscious choice to make it more silent film feeling?
Yep. It's totally what we were going for. I approached the film as less of a narrative in the traditional sense. Like, this guy's in the room talking. He wouldn't be really speaking to anybody.
Yeah.
He's by himself. And I wanted to approach it in such a way that the stuff that he's dealing with, you know, condemnation, judgment, hope, despair, faith, you know, finding a, you know, what propels him to stick around long enough or to try and escape or to survive, what was that internally was happening to keep him going through the story? And I realized, you know, if it was me in a room and there's no one around to talk to, I wouldn't be doing much talking. You know, it'd be internal. So the approach to the film was more of a silent film would be a really good way of looking at it, because it's all internal stuff that's happening. I wanted to try and get the character animated so we saw what was happening inside him. Do you know what I mean? So it was
Absolutely.
Through his expression, through his body movement. So universally, an audience could watch this and not know what language it's in. It doesn't matter. You see what's happening inside this guy's mind by watching his actions and seeing how he reacts to the room around him and what's going on and how he carries himself through the film. The narrative part, the actual narration that happens, was to flesh out the story itself, actually, to help folks that aren't familiar with The Pit and the Pendulum as a story, as Edgar Allan Poe's short story, to hear what the story was saying about the various parts of what the guy's gone through in the film. So in earlier versions of the film, we would show it around and folks commented there, say, you know, I know who Edgar Allan Poe is. I know a little bit about The Pit and the Pendulum. I don't know the story that well that I would connect with what the character is dealing with as far as adaptation is concerned. They say, I see what he's wrestling with this pit and the pendulum, and obviously he's trying to get out of there and stay alive, and then he's rescued, but well, how does that connect with the story? And that was a key point for us, to try and help folks to make that connection with the story itself. So you wouldn't see it as a film as like, here's our version of The Pit and the Pendulum without any connection to the story. Because I feel there's way too many of those that have been done. And it's like, you know, they go on these crazy tangents, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter if you've never read the story ever, you know, because the film kind of runs on its own track. But we really wanted to stick to the story itself, to what Poe had written, and that's where the narration came in. So we play the character as he's in a silent film because, you know, basically he'd be quiet most of the time he's in there, and the narration was really the approach that these are his memories. He's reciting the story. It's like you're watching a projected version of his memory of what happened to him. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Okay, good. So that's where the narration would kick in. And it was also, part of it was we wanted the way we mixed the sound with the 5.1 surround and the way we lit it, and the camera being next to the guy all the time, it was like at his eye level. We wanted to try and get the subliminal feeling that the audience, you know, to help the audience get pulled into the room with him. So if you're sitting in a dark room, like the idea, we wanted it to be screened at really big theaters, you know, so the idea not being like, look at our film at a really big theater, it's just that it's so much more immersive because you're in a dark room. The only thing you can see is what's in front of you, which is what this guy had to wrestle with. The sound is actually wrapping all around you. So you hear water dripping down the walls behind you and rats scurrying down in the front on the side. And, you know, so when you're in a big theater and you see the film, it's really cool because you get pulled right into it. And it becomes more of an immersive experience versus an audience just watching the film experience. And that's, again, part of that silent thing. We wanted people to try and connect the dots by having to watch him closely to see what's happening. And in that, you forget that you're in a theater for a short time, and you become part of the room. You're like someone in the room with him. Hopefully that answered your question.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mark, I'm going to ask you a random question. What Dave said, it's like, this is my chance to ask you this question that I'm dying to ask you. And if this question bombs, we'll just move on to a much better one. But I got to ask out of curiosity. There's this legendary lost film that's never been made, or I want to know if you heard about it or your take on it, this film that David Allen had done and not finished called The Primevals or The Primevals, I think.
Primevals,
thank you. Do you have any take on that? Have you seen this film? Do you know people who have worked on this movie?
It's interesting. So I was living in L.A. in 1990, 91, and I met Dave Allen.
Wow.
And I was really happy I got to meet him before he passed away. It was one of the really cool things in my career. I got to meet with him, and I asked him about it, and which I never thought I'd be able to do. I never thought I would ever get to meet this guy. And I'm sitting there in his office, and we're hanging out, and I asked him about the Primevals. I said, David, what's happening with the Primevals? And he says, we're actually working on that. And this is, you know, 91. And I had two guys I was working with on Land of the Lost that were actually animating Primeval footage. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. I had no idea you guys were doing any of this. He says, oh, it's kind of on the side. We're just shooting some stuff to try and, you know, move it along. And that was the last I'd heard about it being or moving forward as a production with Dave Allen involved. I'd heard a few years ago about some guys that were on that crew initially. Early on, after Dave died, that they were going to try and pick up the pieces and keep moving with it. But that was just a brief kind of flash in the pan and no word about it since then. So I really don't know what's happened to the Primevals. I mean, the actual film that Dave was working on, I don't know what's going on with it at all. But I did have that little bit of information when I was out there.
That's incredibly cool.
No, yeah. Thank you so much. That's awesome. I taught a lost films class at UCCS last semester, and The Primevals was a section where I taught all about the movies, and I showed pictures of it and basically talked with as much information I had about it. But all my students are like, well, what happened to this movie? I'm like, I don't know. So I figured you'd be the excellent person to ask. So.
Right on.
Well, to move back to the Poe thing really quick,
yes.
To say that Poe's work has been made into movies is an understatement. A lot of it tends to be to focus a lot on the morbid and you know the macabre elements of it. What do you tend to think about that? Because I really caught definitely a different feeling from The Pit and the Pendulum.
Right. I ended up doing a lot of research actually before I started this thing, and actually after we were well into getting the script going, because I hadn't read The Pit and the Pendulum in a long time. I hadn't read anything of Poe's since high school, I think, in the like 20 years maybe. And mostly it was because of the stereotypical horror theme, because I'm not a huge horror film fan.
Yeah.
You know, I just, I don't know. I haven't seen Saw. I don't want to. You know, it's just not my thing, right? So I'm more into like Hitchcock and stuff of that sort, stuff that really tells a story and freaks you out on a level that's a bit higher than shock and awe, you know. And I was really kind of not turned on to the Poe stuff that I'd seen. As far as, I mean, Roger Corman did some great stuff, but like 91 was the end of it for me. I was like, okay, whatever, you guys have kind of beat this thing to death, and I just didn't feel that they were telling the stories that Poe had written in a way that reflected what he was writing. You know, there wasn't enough of a psychology behind them. So I started doing all this research on it, and the more I read about it, reading biographies about Poe and interviews with people that knew him, it just became really evident that this guy was a hugely fascinating character. as a person and as an artist. And I wanted to, I guess, try and reflect that aspect of him in our story, as opposed to kind of running down the road that everybody, that the really well-worn road of the stereotypical horror genre writer. You know, like, this guy wrote horror stories. That's what he did. And you say, well, they were gothic horror stories. And they were a different style back in the 1840s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. It was a very different idea of what horror was or what gothic meant. And also with Ray being involved, you know, we wanted to keep it in a classic sense of what those films might be like. So my take was that I wanted to stick closer to what I felt the integrity of Poe's writings were, as opposed to trying to pander to an audience that might want to see, like, a guy get cut in half by a pendulum, or, you know, rats chewing on his face, and that sort of thing. Because I think that stuff just doesn't tell the story. Because it was all about an internal story for this guy, this character, what he's wrestling with internally versus the horrible things in the room are going to do to him physically. I mean, that's always the fear, and that's the horror aspect. But I don't think you need to see those things doing damage to actually feel the horror of it. You know, the horror of it is what's impending, the impending doom, the fact that if you stop for a second, you're going to get destroyed one way or another. And I think that's what's even scarier than seeing it happen. You know, seeing it come about, on play out on screen is well, that's a different kind of horror, you know. It's like getting a bug in your lunch or something. It's like, oh, that's disgusting. You know what I mean? It's, I don't want to eat. Yeah, I just. So I wanted to play it on the interior. And it's scarier for me to think, what if there's a bug in my lunch? What if I open my sandwich and there's a cockroach there? You know? It's like, that's worse for me than seeing the cockroach on my sandwich, you know? I don't know if that makes any sense, but it seems to work for me.
Oh, yes, yes.
But. So that's kind of where we wanted to go with the story, was to keep it in a classic sense, keep it in a sense of what in the vibe that we felt the stories were written as, you know, the character portrayal, the sense of horror, the, you know, the traditional sense of literary gothic horror. And that doesn't mean, you know, chainsaws and decapitations and whatnot in this particular story.
My last question, Mark. Just because, yeah. Stop motion is such a notoriously slow process. Is it especially hard getting started? Like, knowing that, you know, it's going to take weeks, maybe months, just for a few minutes of screen time. Is it tough to just to get those first few images of movement down?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's really hard because it's commitment. You know, it's like getting into a relationship. You know, you're like, you ponder it and you think about it and you're like, geez, I don't know. And then, nah, I'm going to go out and hang out with my friends, you know. And, you know, you do that forever. And then you finally realize, well, if this thing's going to happen, I'm going to have to stick around and do this. You know? and then you get into it. And next thing you know, you're totally into it and you're digging being there. And, you know, everything's groovy. And then your friends call and you're like, sorry, man, I'm busy. And then they're all bummed out at you, you know. And they don't call you anymore, so you keep working. That's kind of how it goes.
Fair enough.
But in the end, you got this great thing to show for it, you know, this wonderful 7-minute magic trick that you can show the same guys, and their, like, jaws hit the floor, and they're just astounded by what came out of that time. And that's really what makes it interesting. But it is really hard to get it started. I mean, it used to be when I was doing commercial work, you'd spend the entire day, you'd walk in the studio at 9, it might be 5 or 6 o'clock at night before you started actually animating.
Wow.
And it's not because you're standing around eating lunch all day, but, you know, you find any excuse not to start. You know, you're just like, oh, I've got to do my breakdown sheets. I've got to tweak the puppet. I mean, there's lots and lots to do, but you find even more to do before you, and you finally get to the point where you've maxed out every possible chore you can do before you start shooting, and then you have to walk on the set and stare at the camera, and you're like, okay, this is it. And the scary part is, you know, you're going to be there. You have to go until it's finished. And oftentimes those days where, you know, you'd shoot for 12, 15 hours. That's just the shooting. And the whole rest of the day that you spent getting ready was, that's just another part of it. So that was part of the thing. You wake up in the morning, you go to work, you're there for like who knows how long. You know, we used to spend 36 hours on set sometimes.
Wow.
You know, doing this stuff. And knowing that on the front end is makes it really hard to want to be there long enough to see the back end of it. You know? But, you know, when you get a really good project and you try and stay fired up about it and excited, and then you go in and you just kind of blank out everything else and you just stay focused and you get lost in it once you get going. And then you just run. You just go until it's done. But, you know, getting the car started is the hardest thing. You know, sometimes you got to get out and roll it down the hill.
Pop the clutch, you know, and you go.
What's that?
And then you pop the clutch and...
You pop the clutch and you don't stop until you hit California,
right? So it was 6 weeks for 7 minutes.
Yeah, we actually had shot like 9.5 minutes of footage. Wow. But we only used 6 minutes, actually. We ended up with 6 minutes of animation. And we cut it down and cut it down. And we shot a whole pile of green screen shots that we didn't use. And there's various reasons for that. Like, they didn't fit in the story. And, you know, other aspects is that Switch VFX was right in the middle of Saw 4, I think. Saw 3 or Saw 4. They were just getting hammered with shots. So we were getting squeezed out as they ended up getting more stuff to do. So we couldn't grab their time anymore, and we had to move our stuff out. So we ended up cutting stuff out that we wanted to put in because they were visual effects shots, and they were just totally slammed. So, and we had a deadline delivery to make. So there's all these variables started coming into play, and in the end, we got this short story. And Felix Vasquez from CinemaCray says, you know, this thing is actually cut to the bone. He says, it's cut so close to the bone, but it tells a story.
Yeah.
You know, and he says, you couldn't lose another second out of this thing, or else it would start, taking away from it. So I think as far as an editorial concerns, we did a really good job editorially. We got it, we put in exactly what you needed to have. But as far as wishing there was more, it's like, yeah, I would have loved to have thrown in another 30 seconds of footage. To just flesh it out, you know, but we couldn't pull it off with this one. Well, hopefully we don't run into that problem on the Raven.
so that's going to be the next project?
I'd like it to be, yeah, we're working on it. I mean, we've got a whole bunch of other stuff we're trying to get going at the same time, but I'm really pushing on the Raven as another project to do this year.
Very cool. So I you brought up the visual effects from the guys over at Switch.
Yep.
I thought it was very interesting because what CG there is in the film is very organic to the movie. You almost don't even notice that it's there.
Yeah. Which shot would you think is CG?
I'm guessing the fire.
Yep. That was that's actually stock footage flames.
Okay.
Nice.
Hey.
There are CG elements. I'm just curious if you can spot what do you think was CG.
Honestly, that's the only thing I could probably pick out in a heartbeat.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
I really think so.
What do you guys, anything else? Anybody else have anything?
I know you mentioned something, but I'll let you discuss it.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, the other part is the Cardinal.
Really?
That entire shot was CG. The wall, the window, the Cardinal, that was completely fabricated in CG.
Sheesh.
Yeah, and the fireboxes when he's being pushed to the edge of the pit,
yeah,
those are completely CG. They didn't exist. Like, we never made them.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And the inside of the pit,
mm-hmm,
like, goes away. There's about a foot and a half of that pit below the rim. The rest of it is CG.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And the dust is all CG that floats in the air. The rays of light, those things are fabricated.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, right? It's just this. The opening shot, the hallway... The actual set ended right behind where the puppets started in the scene. When you first see the puppets, that's where the set ended. Everything behind the puppets, off into the distance, was all CG.
Wow.
It was a green screen.
Yeah. Okay,
all
then.
It's all going to be in the DVD. Like, we break down all this stuff, and we say, this is what it looks like before, and this is what it looks like afterwards, and this is how we did that.
Awesome.
So it's almost like you get to go to stop motion school a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and look, you sent me a list of some of this stuff, and wow, how you actually make a 5.1 mix, is that, did I read that right?
Is yep, 5.1 surround.
But like you're actually going to, I know we talked, you were mentioning that you might actually do what goes into making a mix like that.
Yeah, we did a, we've got two interviews. One that's probably going to be, well, we did one interview that's in the theater, the mix theater. So we've got some footage of a breakdown of mixing the various elements to one of the shots. And then we've got an audio interview that's going to be on the website that'll be a code that you'll have to buy the DVD to get the code to get some of those interviews.
Nice.
Yeah. It's all good.
Right? And then and through the Easter eggs, there'll be some links to go to another page on the site that's going to be hidden, so you won't know that page is there or what's on that page until you find the Easter eggs that gives you the info to find that page. And some of that stuff, that interview stuff, is going to wind up in there as well. And on the DVD, there will be what we call a Foley 101, Foley Studio 101. It's about 15 minutes tour of a Foley studio where all the sound effects are created, like boots on pavement and water dripping down the walls and the helmet hitting the concrete, the stone floor. Ian and Alan from Urban Post Production did a little tour and showed us how they made these various sound effects for the film in the Foley studio. And I don't think I've ever seen a Foley studio tour on a DVD extras list. So
yeah,
I think we may be one of the first ones to have done that.
Yeah,
and we're definitely the first one to do it first. Yeah, I think we're the first ones to ever do it for an animated film.
Yeah.
So that'll be a really cool thing. And it's really cool because these guys are just so brilliant about, you know, telling us about everything that they were doing on the film and specifics, and this is how the bucket was made, and this is how the helmet sounds, and this is what we did for the prisoner being dragged out of the place, and the water was done this way, and creaking pendulum sounds were made like by doing this.
Wow.
It's really neat. It's a really great thing. So that's going to be in the DVD.
Well, I can't wait to see this DVD now.
Yeah, me neither.
Yes. Well, I know you're working away on it. You're still shooting for a late June release?
Yep. Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And can we talk about the comic book?
Yeah.
Okay, because you said...
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about that.
Okay, yeah, go, by all means do.
Yeah, it's, well, Blue Water Comics, Darren out at Blue Water Comics is an awesome guy, one, and we hooked up a couple of months ago on the phone, since he's producing, they're heavy into the production of a Ray Harryhausen Presents series of comic books, Jason and the Argonauts, and... 2 million miles, 20,000 miles to Earth, and I think Invasion from Mars. I think they just did. They've got a stack of books that their stories are based on films that Ray was involved with, and they're really, really popular. So, I knew about Darren through Ray's guys, Arnold Kuhnert, his agent. And Darren knew about me having done the film, but we didn't know each other. So I sent him an email, and then he immediately called me up and said, I've been wanting to talk to you for the longest time. Well, you know, we should do something together. Try and come up with something that we can both work on. And I said, well, I got this idea of doing a comic book for, like, a graphic novel based on the film that we just produced. I said, we'll use the images from the film in a graphic layout, so it's a comic. But we'll dress it up so it looks like the prisoner's journal of this one period of his life. And so that's what the pitch was. Darren jumped on it and said, love it. Let's do it. So that's what we're doing. And hopefully it'll be out in October, November of this year. And we're working on that now. I got the cover art done, get some concept. There'll be concept art in it that was made for the film that hasn't been seen anywhere else. That we've integrated into the book, and it'll be a graphical comic layout, but we're using images from the film with text from the story, and I'm using also images that haven't wound up in the film as well, so we're compositing those things just for the comic book release.
So it's almost like you get to do a director's cut for the comic book.
Yeah, I'm doing a director's cut for the comic book. That's exactly what I'm doing.
Very cool.
We're geeking out over here, Mark. This sounds awesome, man.
And then there's the Monopoly game, and then there's the Twister, Pin the Pendulum Twister game. And we've got our own Pit in the Pendulum Twinkie release that we're going to do.
I just want the action figures. That's what I want.
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting? When we first started this thing, I actually got in touch with Gentle Giant about that. And hopefully they're not listening to this. But we sent them some stuff, and the film hadn't been released. Like, no one's really seen it. And I said, look, we got this thing we're doing with Ray, and it's Edgar Allan Poe, and I got these sculptures. And so I sent them some pictures of the stuff, and they said, yeah, we'll get back to you. This looks really cool. Then I never heard from them. I said, you know what? That's okay. I'll do my own characters.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it turns out Blue Water is doing, they just started a toy line based on their characters for the Ray Harryhausen Presents series. Yeah. And we're talking about how we can approach that with the Pit and the Pendulum and the Edgar Allan Poe stuff.
Very cool.
You know, to try and come up with something. I don't know if it'll be action figures per se, or I would really love to see, you know, just some collector's pieces of maybe limited edition stuff of the Poe character that we use the Pit and the Pendulum.
Yeah.
To act as a kind of a 3D representation of the film, you know, for folks that are interested in the artwork and whatnot and the character. You know, it'd just be neat to have that in the comic book and the DVD. And
oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I think we're both, all of us are kind of in that group, so just saying.
Sign me up, man.
Right on.
Yes. So where can we go to find out more about the film and the release and all the other fun stuff?
Well, there's the Pit and the Pendulum shortfilm.com. That's the website. It's got most of the stuff that we're doing. That's pretty much all the bios and the press that we've done. And
the trailer, too.
Excuse me?
And the trailer as well. I forgot to mention.
Yeah, and it's got the trailer. It's got like a high-res version of the trailer on there. Oh, we're also cutting a new trailer next month as well.
Great.
Very cool.
So I'm going to send that to you guys before anybody sees it.
Yay!
So I think you guys will probably have the exclusive release on that outside of myself. So I'll send it to you guys, and then I'll put it online. But I'll give you a heads up when it's coming, okay?
Aw, sweet. Absolutely.
So you guys will have the first shot at that, and then I need to send it to somebody else, too. But so we're cutting one this coming month, a new trailer for the DVD release. And the blog is where we do all the pretty much the day-to-day. This is what's going on, the screenings, conventions we're going to go to, anything that's coming up or new that's happening with the film. Kind of, it's also sort of a countdown to us getting this thing out the door and reflection of the world tour. We have a little map on there that you can see where it's going, when it's going to be there.
Yeah, what's up, Mr.
All the information for the dates and whatnot. And that's www.thepitandthependulumshortfilm.blogspot.com.
Cool, and we'll put links up there as well.
Yeah, that'd be great. And so, and there's also a MySpace page and a Facebook page. But those are all on the blog. All those links are on the blog, and all the links to the shows are on the blog. And we're actually, we're at Crypticon this weekend coming up. So
cool. Yeah, I was going to say, where are your next few stops coming up?
Yeah, we're at Crypticon Seattle, May 23rd, planned Friday night. And I think we're going to, I'm trying to remember, Toronto Hispano-American Film Festival. We're screening at their awards night on May 25th in Toronto, Ontario, and then we screen in Barcelona in October, and we screen at the Rumorg Festival of Fear. We're going to have a booth there, actually, August 22nd in Toronto.
Cool.
And we're playing, we just got into Copper Con in Phoenix, Arizona, August 21 to 23. That's in Phoenix, Arizona, and I know I'm missing a whole bunch of other dates. I just can't.
Oh, they're all on the page, too.
Yeah, they're all on the page. Oh, I'm playing Melbourne, Australia.
Wow.
In August. Yeah. It's all over the place. It literally is just getting all. And those are the ones that I know of right now. I'm still waiting on like 10 other conventions to give me the go-ahead.
Wow.
To print the stuff. Yeah, it's nuts, right?
No kidding. Very cool.
But it's really great because everybody's seeing this thing and we're getting a lot of attention on it. You know, folks are coming to the blog and checking out the website. And the YouTube thing's going up, so that's good. People have seen the trailer.
Cool.
So hopefully I can keep folks interested long enough to know if they can get the DVD soon. And when that comes out, we're going to try and do some more interesting promotional stuff for that as well.
Cool. Yeah, well, we'll do whatever we can to help pimp. So.
Yes. Well, thanks, man. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Oh, and the T-shirts will be going online probably next month as well. We'll start a store up, and you'll be able to get the T-shirts.
Is that the shirt that I've got?
And posters. Yeah, that's the shirt you've got.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're going to probably do another version of the T-shirt. So right now it's printed on black, but we may do a white T-shirt with a black graphic.
Nice. Very cool.
Well, right? So, yeah. Sweet. So we're going to start that with a contest, likely.
Cool.
On online contest, and we'll do a T-shirt giveaway and some DVDs and stuff. And the posters, we're going to start off with a limited edition. I'm going to sign a bunch of posters, and those will be the first ones out. And after that, you'll be able to buy them online.
That's right. You're saying there's like a pre-order, pre-release type thing if you sign up for the newsletter? Or?
Yeah, if you subscribe on the blog, we have a little subscriber. If you subscribe to the blog, then anybody that subscribes on the gets on the mailing list will get a pre-release offer that's super secret. Nobody knows what that deal is going to be yet, but it'll be really cool, and it'll only be for those people that have subscribed when we release. So I'll give you everybody on that list a heads up, like, this is what's going on. If you want in on it, this is what you do. And then only after that's dealt with, then we'll release the DVD to everybody else. So there'll be some cool stuff in there.
Very cool.
Yep.
Right on. Sweet. Well, thank you so much for your time, Mark.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. And again, the website is the pitandthependulumshortfilm.com. We'll have links up and all that fun stuff.
Brilliant.
And yeah.